Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. As we've only just recently started the retreat, I'd like to go over just a few things to about the retreat. When we entered the retreat, because there was several of us, including myself, who had various loose ends still sort of hanging and things that needed to be wrapped up, and in general there was still things that needed to be done in order to finish off various duties and whatnot, so that I specifically didn't make mention of noble silence at the when we entered the retreat. But now that we've had the time to settle a bit and get various things finished off, then I think it's an appropriate time to bring up that aspect of a retreat, creating a retreat atmosphere. And being attentive to speech and refraining from unnecessary speech. Noble silence doesn't necessarily mean absolute and total silence, but it's really important to take the time to reflect and see, well, what's necessary, what's useful to speak about, what is absolutely critical, and what can just be foregone and left unspoken. And particularly in a time of retreat this is very precious opportunity to be able to cultivate mindfulness, sense restraint, concentration in a consistent way. And if you pay attention to speech, you recognize how much of what we talk about isn't about concentration, sense restraint, mindfulness, wisdom, reflection on the factors of enlightenment. It's usually about something very different. More often than not, it's something sort of uncritical to the holy life, and more often than not is something that is actually going in the opposite direction. So that to give yourself the opportunity to just really check and to put a check on speech, so that there's a real restraint of speech and a cultivation of a turning inward, because so much of speech is just sort of this out outward going flow, outward going exuberance, outward going attention. And as we follow that habit, then we forego the opportunity to turn inwards and to rest in the stillness of the mind, the sort of the quiet of the mind, the solitude of the mind. And that's very unfortunate, because that's really where our peace is. And so that to use it and bring it up as a point of training and checking, seeing, well, what, you know, is this necessary? Is this essential? Is this something that's beneficial? Something on fire in the kitchen, and you don't have to sort of think very much about, is this beneficial? Is this essential? Is this necessary? I mean, you say something, you get, hey, let's get in there and help and get something done here, put this out. But that the vast majority of what we talk about is not that critical. And you know, there's a lot of time in other parts of the year to talk about it, and we do. You know, generally do have fairly full reign of the opportunity to talk and discuss and to bring things up for conversation. But this period of winter retreat is an opportunity to step back from that habit, step back from that tendency, so that for oneself it's beneficial, and generally for others as well. It doesn't, we all enjoy generally, we all enjoy conversation and contact with each other. None of us are misanthropes and completely averse to other human beings. But, so that we generally enjoy contact with each other. But this time of retreat is an opportunity to give each other a break as well, give each other the opportunity to focus attention on practice, on training, on cultivation of the that which is more peaceful, more tranquil, more settled. So to turn attention to that noble silence. And if something is necessary, then to be attentive to the occasion. Is it an appropriate occasion? Is the setting all right? Am I going to disturb anybody by speaking? And then if there is something that is necessary, then how am I bringing it up? What's the level of volume that I'm using? Because even if there is something necessary, it doesn't need everybody in the whole house to know about it either. It's just bring up something in a quiet way, using a quiet voice, in a way that is not going to disturb others as well. So just bring real mindfulness into speech, because again, it's not, when I'm saying noble silence, I'm not sort of trying to enforce and police absolute quiet, but I'm trying to really really get everybody to be reflective on, you know, what's useful, what's necessary, and you know, what are the ways of using speech that are not going to impinge impinge on one's own well-being and impinge on other people's efforts at meditation and developing their inner solitude, inner quiet. So it's very just being sensitive and respectful to each other as well. You know, that's part, you know, very much a part of living in community, recognizing that our effects, our actions have effects on others. So trying to support each other in this retreat, as well as supporting ourselves, giving ourselves the opportunity for our minds to and hearts to really settle. As it is difficult for the mind to settle. It's not so easy. And you know, one of the things that is is an obstacle or is an impediment to the peaceful mind is a lot of sound and noise, and particularly the speech of others, because it, you know, we're just as human beings, we're naturally attuned to the human voice, and you know, the mind goes out to it. You know, when we're sitting in the forest, you know, if you notice that if you're sitting in the forest, and there can be all sorts of birds singing and the sound of wind in the trees and the you know, various natural sounds, and the mind doesn't really pick it up that much. But if somebody happened to be even, you know, walking through the forest with a couple people, and they were speaking with each other, and even it doesn't have to be raucous speech, but it's just the mind goes to it. It's just natural. It's nature. We're as human beings, we're attuned to the sound of each other. So that during this period of retreat, to give each other the opportunity to have a break from the mind going out to speech, conversation, and just general noise, and to turn more towards those quiet and more peaceful parts of the mind, and giving that the precedence. Obviously the retreat helpers need to be consulting with each other, and sometimes need to be consulting with us for concerning duties and whatnot, and that that's completely appropriate, necessary, but to also gauge the volume and the situation, so that it's not impinging on others. One of the things I did bring up when we started the retreat was that I'd like people to come in and out of the hall at the time of the sort of the specific times. It will be ringing the bell. Say in the morning, it would be on the hour. Say at 9:30, and ending at 10:30, and then in the afternoons, bells would be rung in the sort of 45-minute intervals, and to be entering or leaving the hall at that time. And that, I'd really like people to hold to that, to keep that. And if people are just sort of coming in and out of the hall at all times, and it's very disruptive. And if we're trying to cultivate sort of an atmosphere of mutual support for meditation and practice, then it's important that the hall is really creating a space where it's conducive to practice, conducive to there's a sense of supporting and supporting each other. So coming in and out of the hall, and really at those times, and also for the people who are ringing the bells, to be attentive to ringing the bells at those times, so that we can be doing that. And if there's if there's a sitting going, because I'm not trying to get everybody to you have to be sitting and walking everybody at the same time, but if there's a sitting going on in here, and the person who is ringing the bell is just ringing the little bell that you can just hear inside, then if those people who are walking, then to wait and pay attention to, okay, has the person in the hall rung the bell yet? So that people are getting up and moving, rather than sort of, I'm done with my walking meditation, I'm going into the hall now. People start traipsing in and out at all different times. And similarly, if the bell is being rung outside, the person who is ringing the bell is doing walking meditation, then to wait for that the bell to be rung. Whether if you're sitting in here waiting for that bell to be rung, and rather than sort of getting up, done with my sitting now, I'm going to go and do walking meditation. And then getting up when everyone wants, and wait for that bell to go when you hear it from the outside. It just makes it a much more conducive atmosphere for meditation when there's just not people going in and out all the time. Also, when you do come in, I mean, it's impossible to sort of get everybody lined up at the door and come in and all exactly the same time. It's just not going to happen. But when you do come into the hall, and that, so whether it's during the meditation or when it's during the evenings here, make coming into the hall or getting up and going out a meditation as well, because some people are wanting to sit through two or three sessions, unless one is in deep enough samadhi that the one isn't attending to sound at all. Then it's an impingement if people are going in and out of the hall not very mindfully. So that coming into the hall, the door has a handle, And all you can just take, be mindful and recognize there is the handle of the door, and to gently pull on the handle, and the door will open. Doors are meant to open, and unless it's locked, which it probably won't be, it's not necessary to just grab the handle and rip the door open, worried that it might not open or something. You can feel that sometimes. Somebody is like, and just is pulling this door apart, and just, and as. And there's no rush to come in. I mean, nobody's going to take your seat. Come into the hall slowly. Put your hand on the door and just pull it gently. And also, you don't need to turn the handle. Just pull on it gently. Open it slowly. Let it close behind you gently. And then come slowly to one seat. Pay attention to each step as you come to your meditation spot. Just walk, and just each, how you're putting down your foot on the floor. Make it a meditation. There are quiet and noisy ways to walk in a room, or anywhere for that matter. On the Thanksgiving retreat, there was one person who, it didn't take me that long to recognize. I could hear her coming before she even got to the door. You could hear her coming down the hall and then opening the door, and okay, she had a characteristic thump. Thump, 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 thump. Coming up to the door to come into the meditation hall. When you're coming in, pay attention to how you put your foot down. Just not putting your heels down first. Either put the ball of your foot down and walk that way, coming in. And then come to one's, when you get to your place, and you do your bows quietly, gently. There's no need to sort of sigh or another meditation. If that's the way one feels, we can just sort of feel it inside. We can all empathize. It is just to come in, and there's no need to sort of sometimes people get ready for meditation, nobody here, so far anyway. It's like they're preparing getting their nasal passages all cleaned up. It's really you're doing it in a meditation hall with a whole bunch of people. This is having a sensitivity that other people are in the hall. Trying to do things as quietly as possible, and gently, mindfully, slowly. There's no rush to get to your seat. And also, when if you're wanting to sort of arrange your cushions, or if you're just coming in newly, then You know, you're picking up your mat or rearranging your mat. You know, just to do that as quietly as possible. You know, like sometimes coming in and it's like, you know, you can hear people somehow. It's like dropping their cushions from about waist height, and then getting it sort of settled before getting themselves in, and just to be aware that that makes noise, and getting oneself settled, and just really try to be as quiet as possible. It is a meditation to be as composed as possible, as quiet as possible. A good role model is Ajahn Pratip. He comes in and out of the hall. He's usually very quiet. So it's possible, not impossible to do. Also for just around the hall and during the times of meditation, particularly the monk's room, and to be very conscious that during the mornings and the afternoons, then this is a place of the next door in the hall here is a place of meditation, and because these walls are very, very thin, and you can hear when you go into, people go into their cupboards, or go into drawers, turn taps on. You can hear everything. Even when you turn taps on outside in the building on the outside, you can hear that inside the hall here. So that to be very, if there's something really necessary that you have to get out of your cupboards or other drawers, and to be very, very quiet in doing that, opening a drawer or opening a cupboard, closing it. Just to close a door, don't just sort of let it close or push it closed. I mean, just bring the door to a closed position with your hand on it, so that it doesn't make any noise. Make a point of learn of making it that point of mindfulness. The same next door on this side. If going in and out of this hall here, this side here, the book room, if that door in and out, you can hear it when it's going in. Also, it's sometimes it's necessary to put the fan on in there if there's a lot of moisture. But during the meditations, it makes the noise of the fan comes into the hall, so to not leave it on during those times, so it doesn't impinge on everybody else. So that these basic points of mindfulness and attentiveness to say the others that are around us, and both for ourselves, just a sense of composure, mindfulness, slowing down, coming more, turning more inward. When there's, you say, restraint of speech and a real carefulness around our movement, and just simple things are coming in and out of the hall, it does create a quality of composure that's very helpful for our meditation, and both for ourselves, and then of course for the kind of the group atmosphere that's created. Because if everybody is putting attention onto that, it really sort of lifts up the level of sharpness and clarity. And that's beneficial, it helps everybody. In another vein, or sort of take another tack in terms of, I mean, that's just sort of the logistics, to return to the five hindrances. Working with these hindrances, meditation, a lot of the meditation is working skillfully with these five hindrances. And these last days I've brought it up several times. But it's quite there's many ways that one can use that theme of the hindrances to work with the meditation, and one of the ways that is very useful is the as one's developing the practice and trying to settle and compose the mind to using those the in the commentaries they line up the five hindrances beside the five factors of the first jhana, and that's a really it's a very nice way of both seeing how those factors of jhana are not just something that manifest out of thin air. They arise out of the overcoming and skillful diminishing of the hindrances. And also that the hindrances have specific antidotes that are useful to bring up when one is confronting a particular hindrance. So that the way that it's generally sort of lined up is that they say, well, the five factors of jhana are vitakka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata. Vitakka as the initial thought, awareness. Sometimes it's even used around to say that sustained awareness, and then vichara is more used as reflection as well. But I like to use that initial and sustained thought as vitakka vichara. The initial thought as vitakka, sustained thought around vichara, and then vichara you can branch off into more reflective aspects if one wishes, but it's on a basic level, vichara is that sustained thought. Piti as in joy or rapture, sukha and happiness, ekagata as one-pointedness of mind, the focus of mind. And the vitakka is lines up with is its opposite is the sloth and torpor. Vichara is the antidote for doubt, skeptical doubt, vichikicca. Bhiti, joy or rapture, is sort of the antidote for ill will and aversion. Sukha, happiness, is the kind of the antidote for restlessness and worry. And ekakata, one-pointedness, is the antidote for sensual desire. So that vitakka, the quality of vitakka, is that lifting up of the mind, that initial thought, the raising up of the clear intention in the mind, the raising up of a thought process in the mind, raising up of an object in the mind. And just that raising up in itself is goes against the kind of the lassitude, sloth, torpor of the mind that's sinking. It's sort of sinking, it's drifting, it's diffuse, it's kind of lazy, shiftless mind. Yeah. So that vitakka, that raising up of the initial thought, the raising up of the thought process, raising up of attention, bringing attention onto an object, bringing attention onto the breath, bringing attention onto the buddho, whatever, lifting of attention onto an object, vitakka. And as soon as you lift that up, that very effort dispels that sloth, that sort of lassitude of mind. And so as one continues to lift that up, then one then that sloth and torpor is dispelled. It needs that initial lifting up to be able to get past the sloth and torpor. And obviously one needs to, if the mind drifts or is unable to sustain attention, one has to keep lifting the mind up. And again, that sort of there's no sort of model that is absolutely perfect. And so because one does, in order to sort of say maintain or to really dispel sloth and torpor, then one needs to sustain that lifting up of the mind. But I think as a model goes, this is a good sort of, okay, these are sort of basic antidotes. But that, I remember one time watching Ajahn Chah, he was one of the senior monks at Wat Pho Phong, and he's just a little bit junior to Ajahn Liam. And he and Ajahn Liam took on a lot of duties at Wat Pho Phong during the time that I was training there. And one time Ajahn Chah was off, he went to a katina somewhere, I think it was up at Ajahn Kinrali's monastery, which was it was a couple hundred kilometers north, and or went to a ceremony, and then they up all night there, drove back, that day, came back to Wat Pa Pong, and there was another all-night session happening. They arrived basically right in time for evening puja, came into evening puja, and most of the others went back to rest after. And Ajahn Chah stayed on after the after evening puja, and there was it was some sort of ceremony because there was talks that night, and he was, I mean, he was obviously really tired because he wanted just helping out at a ceremony, then being up all night the night before and driving the whole next day and not getting any sleep at all, and then sitting listening to more boring talks on Dhamma. He was falling asleep, but he kept picking himself up, and just that lifting up of the, you could just sort of feel that he was lifting himself up, and he'd fall asleep and he'd pick himself up, he'd fall asleep and pick himself up, and that way because the talk started probably about 10 o'clock at night, and he'd fall asleep, he'd just go down, he'd pick himself up. And then it's about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and you see him pick himself up. And he didn't move after that, until about, till morning chanting, 3 or 3:30. It just kept working with that. Okay, lifting up the mind, lifting up the mind, lifting up the mind, lifting up the mind, bringing the mind back. And that sloth and torpor just dissipates. Because one's gaining that energy from the lifting up and putting the mind on the object. So that vitakka, lifting up the mind to the object, lifting up the attention to the Dhamma, lifting up the awareness to what one should be attentive to. So that vitakka is a very important quality of mind, that we need to have the patience to just keep bringing the mind back to its object. Keep bringing the mind back to the Dhamma, keep lifting up the mind to that which is wholesome and skillful. Vichara is a sustained application of mind, and that is in this model is the antidote for doubt, skeptical doubt, wavering. So that as one sustains attention on an object, sustains attention on the Dhamma, sustains awareness on the teachings, things become clear, and obviously that that vichara is if you sustain attention on an object of sensuality, then you're going to have a very different result. Intrinsically vichara is the bringing the mind to the an object of meditation or an object of awareness. It has a wholesome connotation. One's reflecting on Dhamma. One isn't just absorbing into having sustained attention on some thought of ill will or something. That is a whole different kettle of fish. But that vichara is that bringing attention to the either to meditation object, to a theme of contemplation, and as one sustains that attention and sustains that application of mind, then doubt, wavering, skepticism, is dispelled. It doesn't have a hold, and doesn't grab the mind in the same way that it does did before. So that too, working with this vichara, sustained application, so that there's waver, not buying into that sort of wavering and doubtful quality of mind. Piti of joy, rapture, sort of delight in things, really dispels that negativity of aversion. And you know, it's something that we can bring attention to. Bringing attention to that which is joyful, or is has a sense of delight in it, of something which is very wholesome, something is associated with Dhamma, associated with a memory of something, associated with a quality of well-being. Those are thoughts of obvious thoughts of loving kindness are intrinsically wholesome in that way, tending to a sense of well-being and warmth within the heart, so that has the capacity to dispel that tendency to the hindrance of aversion, ill will, dislike, anger. So it's the antidote that one needs to bring attention to. The sukha, the quality of happiness, and happiness both in terms of internally of within the mind, the heart, being very happy, and physically as well, that quality of feeling very full, replete, happy in that way. In the commentaries, when they talk about try to give the illustration, well, what's the difference between piti and sukha? What's the difference between joy and happiness? Then they give the illustration of a person who is walking in a desert or in an area on a journey that is in the wilderness, and you're hot, you're tired, you're thirsty, and there's no break in it. It just seems endless. But then you see somebody who's they look like they've just, their hair is wet, they look fresh, they're clean, and they're not dusty, and they look refreshed, and they tell you, oh yeah, I've just come from like an oasis, an area where there's a pond, there's trees for shade, there's good drinking water there, there's a place for bathing, it's a place where you can rest. And what would come up in the mind is this joy. Wow, okay, looking forward to that, this excite joy. And then when one actually gets to that place, one's able to bathe, refresh one's body, to drink as much nice, clean, pure water, dispel one's thirst, sit under the shade in a cool spot, and just to be able to feel physically and mentally at ease and happy. That's a difference between, say, joy and happiness. The joy is more on the mental level of the that kind of rapture and certain expectation of more to come, and the happiness is more of there's a settled and replete feeling that is through the body and the mind. So that sukha, that happiness, is the antidote to restlessness, worry, that kind of agitation in the mind that is there, so that when there's that feeling of tranquility in the body, the mind feeling replete and full, then that restlessness has nowhere to stand. It's dispelled. It's in abeyance. It's settled. In meditation, bringing attention to those things that are physically and mentally relaxing, settling, peaceful, pleasing to the mind, pleasing to consciousness, and pleasing in the sense of in accordance with Dhamma as well. It always has one has to qualify that. The sensual desire, the antidote being ekakata, being one-pointedness of mind. There's that tendency of the mind to go out is so strong. To be able to bring the mind and settle it on a point of awareness and to return to that point of awareness, that one-pointedness. And sort of that strong sort of draw and pull, fascination with something other than the present moment, something else that's going to fulfill, something outside that's going to satisfy, and that sensual desire is always going out, looking for gratification, satisfaction, fascination. Looking for the and that's the Gajahn Chah using the image of the person looking for the turtle with a mustache, and that's it's like looking for happiness in sensual desire, looking for satisfaction in the world outside, and so looking for the turtle with the mustache. It's always, one never finds it, not yet anyway. It's not. I don't think there's a genus of in the animal realm that is devoted to turtles with mustaches. It just isn't there. That returning to one-pointedness, ekakata. And in terms of how we work with it, oftentimes what I do when I'm sitting is just return to that, with the breath. Vitakka, lifting the as the breathing in. Vitakka, bringing the mind up to the sensation of the tip of the nose or in the body itself. Vichara, just feeling the whole body as the breath goes out. As the breath comes in, piti, really bringing in a quality of joy and light. And sukha, as the breath goes out, on the out-breath, to sukha in terms of pervading it through the whole body. As the breath comes in, ekagata, holding that one point. As the breath goes out, ekagata, holding that one point. And vitakka, bringing the breath in. So following that through, that vitakka vijara, piti sukha, ekagata, pervading the lifting up awareness, sustaining it, pervading awareness and a sense of well-being through the whole body, through the mind, and just working with that, one pointing. And then when everything feels very settled, then to drop the use of the verbiage of using those words, and then just staying with the sensation of the breath as it comes in, the breath as it goes out, finding a point that is clear, and the mind is interested to stay there, and to hold that, work with that, staying with that, what's it feel like? Or if one wants to move attention through the body, how does one sustain that attention? And if the mind starts to wander, one loses that track again. Okay, vitakka, lifting up attention, bringing it to the breath, all the way in, right to the end of the in-breath. Vichara, the breath going out, feeling the whole body, feeling attention going through the whole body, pervading the whole body with awareness. So breath comes in, bringing piti into, bringing that sense of joy and lightness, brightness into the meditation, into the heart. Sukha, just letting that pervade, breathing out, letting it settle, pervade through the whole body. Ekagata, holding, coming to one point. So that, using it as a theme to work with the meditation, working with the breath, sort of becoming, this is that cultivating the mindfulness of breathing, to offer that for reflection this evening.
Om namo brahmakritaya sadhukaram.